This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome back to the Dear Show. Before we get to the Mayorkas impeachment, which has been defeated by the Senate, and we'll talk about that at length, update on college presidents. Today, the president of Columbia was grilled by Congresswoman Stefanik, who was really doing a superb job of going after these college presidents. And, you know, they were much better prepared by their lawyers. I suspect they had better lawyers. I mean, the lawyers who prepared the first three college presidents, you know, Harvard, Penn, and MIT, I can't believe what an incompetent job they did. When you're asked a question, is it okay for a university student or faculty member to call for the genocide of Jews? The answer is very simple. You say, no, of course not. Now let me explain the First Amendment and complexities. But you say no, no. You know, it's like the dumb answer that the lawyer for Donald Trump gave when he argued in the D.C. Circuit. And he was asked, does your argument about immunity, would it extend to a president who ordered his political opponent in a presidential election to be assassinated? Well, the obvious answer is, no, it wouldn't apply. You can't order the assassination of a presidential candidate, but the lawyer, well, it depends. It has to be impeached first, then maybe. No, no, you have to learn, if you're a public figure, that there are sometimes one-syllable answers. No, or yes, now let me explain. So, they were briefed better, and they all answered the question, if a student or a faculty member advocated the genocide of Jews, would they be in violation of the school's policies? Yes, yes, yes. Then they were asked about a particular professor named Joseph Massad. I happen to know this guy. He's a virulent anti-Semite, anti-Israel, bigot, and he's on the Columbia faculty, but he has tenure. But he's also chairman of various things. And so should he preserve his role as chairman? Well, you know, Columbia made a horrible mistake by giving him tenure. I know, because I strongly opposed it when he was up for tenure. The guy is a fake. He's not a serious academic. His work is trivial. His work is completely political and biased. He never should have gotten tenure in the first place. It's like the woman who was recently banned from giving the valedictory address at the University of Southern California. You know, once you appoint somebody to give the valedictory address, you shouldn't be disqualifying them because of their political views. But what if they're picked because of their political views? Was this the top-ranking student in the school? Apparently, there were a lot of qualified students. The question is, did they pick her because she was virulently anti-Israel in order to send a message of anti-Israel feelings? If so, if she's picked for political reasons, she can be dismissed for political reasons. If she's picked for academic reasons, then no, she shouldn't be able to be dismissed for political reasons. So it's so important to get context and understanding of these issues. I know, because I've been in academia 60 years, and I know the deep rot that runs through so many academic institutions. It used to be, you know, colleges. Now it's extending to law schools and medical schools, high schools. The virulent anti-Americanism, anti-Semitism, you know, anti-decency that runs through so many faculty members. You know, at places like Harvard, you can't get somebody to speak up on behalf of Jewish students who are being harassed and are being discriminated against. But nobody wants to take on the anti-Israel students in a courageous way without denying them First Amendment rights. You know, the marketplace of ideas should be open to everybody, but at places like Harvard, it's not open to everybody. Pro-Israel speakers like me are not invited to speak at Harvard and to help the Jewish students or the pro-Israel Christian students or students in general come to grips with some of the anti-Semitism. No, I'm not invited. But anybody who's anti-Israel, oh, they get invited, and faculty members sign statements, free speech, free speech. Yeah, I'm in favor of free speech, but not only for one side, for all sides. The marketplace of ideas requires diversity. You know that word, diversity? It doesn't mean only more Black people. It means diversity of ideas, which includes Republican ideas, conservative ideas, right-to-life ideas, and it includes pro-Israel ideas. But I can't express pro-Israel ideas on the Harvard campus. I have never, in the 10 years since I've been away from Harvard, ever been invited to express a pro-Israel idea at Harvard. Once I was asked to come by Chabad, and they were supposed to have it in law school, but they moved me away from the law school. They took me to a place three blocks away, the little Chabad headquarters, and let me talk to Chabad students. But they didn't want me to speak to the law school in general. When I was there, I would get 1,000 students coming to listen to me speak. Students want to hear me speak, but I'm controversial. And it's okay if I'm controversial on the hard left side, on the anti-Israel side, but if I'm controversial on the pro-Israel side, and God forbid, I actually defended Donald Trump. My God, what a terrible thing for a lawyer to have done. A Harvard Law School graduate defended Donald Trump. Do we really want him here? He defended Jeffrey Epstein. My God, he defended, you know, O.J. Simpson. He defended Klaus von Bülow. We don't want people like that in a law school. Oh, it'll teach students the wrong lesson, that everybody's entitled to a defense and that everybody's entitled to free speech. We certainly don't want that lesson to be taught to Harvard Law students. So, you know, there is a deep, deep, deep double standard that operates at every single major university in the United States, and it's spreading beyond universities to high schools and even to middle schools. So I'm going to continue to fight it, but I'm not getting an audience because I'm not being invited to present my points of view. I'm being silenced. I'm being canceled because I took positions that are critical of the Harvard faculty, the Harvard administration, and the administrations of other colleges. Now I'm going to take a position that is extremely critical of Republicans, and you're not going to like it. Turn off the tube, you know, shut me down if you don't want to hear what I have to say. But if you want to hear what I have to say, let me tell you that the Republicans have been incredibly hypocritical on this Mayorkas impeachment. Here, I have the impeachment articles in front of me. There are two articles of impeachment. Neither of them satisfy the criteria of the Constitution: treason, bribery, other high crimes and misdemeanors. The first article of impeachment is entitled Article 1. Willful and systematic refusal to comply with the law. Where's that in the Constitution? Where is that in the Constitution? It's not. What about Article 2? Breach of public trust. These are precisely the kinds of things that A, the framers strongly were opposed to, and B, the very Republicans who are now today calling for Mayorkas' impeachment on these non-constitutional grounds. These are the same people who stood up for Donald Trump and correctly pointed out that he was impeached on grounds that are not in the Constitution, abuse of power, obstruction of Congress. And I argued successfully in front of the Senate, and they all applauded me, and they came over and they hugged me, and they told me how I was correct and how they agreed with me. You can't impeach somebody just because you agree with their policies, you disagree with their policies, you disagree with anything about them. You have to point to crimes. You have to point to treason, to bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Look, in my argument, I said, it's okay if it's not a technical crime, as long as it's criminal type behavior. So it could, for example, be something that would be a crime if it had taken place within 2 years, but it took place 5 years ago. Okay, you can do that. Or it could be something that isn't technically a crime, but is so much like a crime that you can say it's a high crime and misdemeanor. But you can't say that abuse of trust. You can't say that the various things, willful and systematic refusal to comply with the law, you can't say that that's an impeachable offense or breach of public trust. And so Congress was absolutely correct. The Senate was absolutely correct in dismissing Article 1. Article 1 didn't even purport to instate an impeachable offense. The Republicans, the same people who complained about Article 1, Article 2, you know, in the Trump impeachment, the same people wanted to support this. And although I'm not, you know, a fan of Chuck Schumer, he was right to get the Senate to, in a close vote, but to get it to dismiss the first charge without even a trial, because you don't need a trial. If the allegations don't rise to an impeachable offense, there can't be a trial. It's like a motion to dismiss in a civil case or a motion to dismiss in a criminal case. You don't have a trial. If somebody's charged with the crime of not being nice, you don't have to have a trial to prove whether he was nice or not. It's not a crime not to be nice. And it's not a crime to do the two things that were alleged in Article 1 and Article 2. Now, Article 2 is a little more complicated. Let me explain why. The heading of Article 2 is clearly not within the constitutional confine, and it should be the heading. That's what you impeach on. Article 2, breach of public trust, not an impeachable offense, not even a close question. That's the framers of the Constitution rejected that out of hand. But if you go and look within the Article 2, it says Alejandro Mayorkas has knowingly made false statements and knowingly obstructed lawful oversight. Well, lawful oversight of the homeland, that's nonsense. That's not in the Constitution. But knowingly made false statements. And so Senator Lee and others have said that does rise to the level of a constitutional offense because it's perjury. No, it's not. You have to read what the allegations are. The allegations are not that he committed perjury. The allegations are that he said something under oath that Republicans disagreed with. He said the borders are safe. That's an opinion. You can't be indicted for perjury for expressing an opinion, even if it's wrong. So even though he's charged with unlawfully making a false statement, the alleged false statement that he's accused of making could not, under the law, be the basis for perjury, and it's not even close. Opinions are protected by the First Amendment. There's no such thing as a false opinion, quoting Chief Justice Rehnquist, who was a Republican. And the law is clear. The First Amendment protects any opinion. The earth is flat. Yeah, all right. You know, it's wrong, but you can say it. The Holocaust never occurred. You can say it. You can say that. It's an opinion. It's a fact that you can disprove it. But if somebody says, you know, I went to Poland and I went to Auschwitz and it didn't exist. It never, there were never any crematorium there. That's a fact. And if a person says that, you know, maybe if they knew they were lying, you could prosecute them for perjury. That, even that would be very, very, very hard. But Article 2 does not charge the crime of perjury. It charges making a false statement. Making a false statement is not perjury. Perjury requires that it be a deliberately, willfully made, material false statement. It has to be material, it has to be false, and the defendant has to know it's false. It can't be based on a mistake, and it cannot be based on an opinion. I know, I've studied this, I know, I've litigated these cases, and they know, and Senator Lee knows because he's a brilliant, brilliant lawyer. And Senator Cruz, he was in my class. Of course he knows. He was a great student. And he knows that you can't be prosecuted for perjury for expressing an opinion. I think the borders are secure. No, I don't think the borders are secure. And by the way, Mayorkas was wrong. The borders aren't secure. The Republicans are right. But they wanted to use this for political purposes. They wanted to use it to try to have hearings on the border. They can have hearings on the border. That's fine. They control the House of Representatives by a couple of votes, but they do. And they can have hearings, and they have had hearings. The hearings today, the Stefanik hearings, were conducted by Republicans. There were a couple of Democrats there who asked some dumb questions about, colleges. But you know, you can have hearings. You can even have a vote to condemn Mayorkas. That's okay. I don't like him, but you could have technically a vote to the House of Representatives votes to condemn Mayorkas because he said that the borders were safe and we know the borders aren't safe. You do that. You cannot impeach him. Impeachment is a constitutional issue. It is not a political issue. It is a legal constitutional issue. No matter how bad the person is, unless they've committed treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors, you can't impeach them. How do I know? Because the Republicans all told me that when I was defending Trump on that ground. Now they're changing their mind. E pluribus hypocrite. That's the motto of the United States. Equally applicable to the Democrats and the Republicans. Democrats are just as bad. The Democrats who believe that you could impeach Donald Trump for obstruction of Congress and abuse of power suddenly are becoming purists. Oh, no, if it's a Democrat. If it's Mayorkas, no, you can't impeach him unless it's treason, bribery, other high crimes and misdemeanors. Utter hypocrisy on both sides. Let me tell you what's happened to impeachment. It's become what Alexander Hamilton feared most. In the Federalist Papers, he said that for impeachment to turn on who has the majority in Congress, in the Senate, would be the greatest danger, the greatest, not the second greatest danger, the greatest danger. And we've seen the greatest danger we wrote about. Impeachment is dead in the water. It is no longer a valid constitutional basis. And when we have a president like Nixon, who should have been impeached and would have been impeached had he not resigned, next time that happens, nobody's going to take impeachment seriously. They're going to remember it for what it was with Bill Clinton. Come on, you don't impeach somebody because he may have told a fib about whether or not he had a relationship, an improper relationship, any more than you prosecute Donald Trump for paying hush money and denying that he had an affair with a porn star. You know, you reserve the criminal justice system, you reserve the impeachment power for serious matters. That both parties should agree to. It should be bipartisan. There shouldn't be any disagreement. If somebody's committed a crime, there wasn't disagreement about Richard Nixon. Why did Richard Nixon resign? Not because the Democrats impeached him or would have impeached him, but because the Republicans, because his own party came to him and said, Mr. President, sorry, we're going to vote to impeach and remove you unless you resign because you've committed impeachable offenses. He committed destruction of evidence, obstruction of justice, perjury, you name it. He committed multiple impeachable offenses. I supported that impeachment, but I did not support the impeachment of Clinton. I did not support the impeachment of Trump, and I do not support the impeachment of Mayorkas. That's over now. The Senate has now voted not to have a trial. That is the right decision. You know, you folks out there who love me when I support the Republicans, start hating me when I expose the hypocrisy of the Republicans. But I'm also exposing the hypocrisy of the Democrats. Look, this is not political for me. I haven't at this point even made up my mind whether I'm going to remain a Democrat. I'm going to wait and see about a lot of things and to see whether the Democrats are willing to marginalize the extreme left of the party or whether the extreme left is moving more to the center. For me, this is not political. For me, this has always been constitutional. And that's why I actually said if I had been asked by Mayorkas to defend him in front of the Senate, I would have done it as eagerly as I defended President Trump in front of the Senate, because they were both impeached for improper constitutional bases. And you should have the same standards, the shoe on the other foot test. Whatever the test is for one has to be for the other. And you can't say that you need criminal conduct to impeach if it's a Republican like Trump, which Republicans said, but you can have a non-criminal procedures and criteria if it's a Democrat, which some Republicans are saying. And you can't do the opposite. Democrats were saying, well, you don't need to have a crime. Adam Schiff you don't need to have a crime. What's Dershowitz talking about? Elizabeth Warren. I don't even understand Dershowitz's argument. Yes, she does. And now suddenly the argument she didn't understand, she's espousing. It's just absurd. It's just absurd. And we, the American people, deserve better. And we're not getting it. We're not getting it. So today was a good day for Congress in the Stefanik hearings. And I think she's turned out to be really a very effective. I don't agree with a lot of the things she stands for. She was not on the right side of election denial. But I support her strongly and how she's been taking on university presidents and really doing an effective job, really doing her homework and doing an effective job. A plus for Congress on that. D minus with great inflation. No, I probably ought to give, even with great inflation, F. For the hypocrisy of everybody on both sides. I don't remember if there's anybody. Has Mitt Romney taken the right view? Mitt Romney, as a Republican, voted to impeach Trump. But did he vote to impeach or not to impeach? I don't know. It didn't come to a vote, really. It came to all kind of procedural votes. Are there any principled people in the House and the Senate? There are. I know some of them. But sometimes politics trumps principles. And I'm going to call that out, whether they're my friends or not, whether they're members of a party I voted for many years or not. We have to have the same standards. And the same standards are you don't impeach anybody under the Constitution unless they've committed treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. And other high crimes and misdemeanors means acts that are akin to treason and bribery, extortion, perjury, any crimes like that, or criminal type behavior like that. But it doesn't apply to the two articles of impeachment that were brought to the Senate today by Republicans from the House of Representatives. So it was a good decision by the Senate to dismiss those charges. Now, it wasn't a principal decision. They did it only because they're Democrats and he's a Democrat. They would have come to exactly the opposite conclusion if the same criteria, false, unconstitutional criteria, had been applied to a Republican. So I'm not giving credit to the Senate or to Schumer for this. He just did it for political reasons, happened to come out the right way, but he did it for political reasons. But you can be sure that if the shoe were on the other foot, they would have come to exactly the opposite conclusion. Okay, let's look at some letters. This one fits right in. Impeachment is a purely political process, which is why it is given to politicians. It is correct to use it as opponents have done. Wrong. It was a debate. Go back and read the debates. Read the Federalist Papers, and you'll see it is not entirely a political process. It is a political process in the sense that it has to start in the House and goes to the Senate, governed by constitutional rules, just the way elections are governed by constitutional rules. You can't simply ignore those rules. You can't ignore the impeachment rules as well. How about his lies to Congress? He insisted borders closed, which obviously it's not. That's an opinion. That's not subject to a perjury prosecution. And everybody in the Senate and everybody in the House knows that. If impeachment is not the correct action, what is the remedy for an executive branch officer that decides to ignore the law? Well, first, you try to get him fired. You have hearings. You condemn him. You issue a resolution of condemnation. But you can't impeach him or amend the Constitution. If you want to amend the Constitution, I might be in favor of that. Amend the Constitution and set out other criteria for removal than treason, bribery, other crimes and misdemeanors. But until the Constitution is amended, ask Justice Scalia, ask the conservative justices. You have to look to the text of the Constitution. You have to look at the original intention of the framers of the Constitution. And they would all agree that the Mayorkas charges do not qualify as impeachable offenses. Okay. Is violating your oath of office a high crime or misdemeanor? No. No, it's not. It could easily have been that. They could easily have said treason, bribery, other high crimes and misdemeanors in violation of the oath of office. They didn't say that. They said the opposite. They said maladministration is not an impeachable offense. Again, whatever the standard is for one, it has to be for the other. And you can't have a different rule for Republicans than for Democrats. Okay, back to the issue about NPR and PBS. NPR and PBS both need to lose all federal funding. Absolutely. And by the way, it wouldn't hurt them that much because much of their funding comes from rich people and foundations and elitists. So they'll still be able to be on the air and still be able to be biased, but the government won't be part of it. And you won't be paying your taxes to hear points of view that you think are dead wrong. And there's something very wrong with that. The government of the United States should not be funding people to take positions. Somebody wrote to me, though, about the Voice of America. That's a different issue. The Voice of America was set up to be a propaganda wing of the United States government against communism. Okay, I can understand that. It didn't purport to be an objective news telling, and it's not designed for American audiences. It's designed for foreign audiences that don't have First Amendment rights. So I can understand the Voice of America, but not NPR, not PBS. They shouldn't get a nickel. Or have set up a separate station. Opera, classical music, jazz. Okay, but by the way, if it's federally funded, it shouldn't appeal only to elite music tastes. I happen to have an elite music taste. I love opera. I love, you know, classical music, but I don't want the government to subsidize my taste. If you want to have country music, if you want to have the government pay for music, they have to pay for country music too. I don't like country music particularly. I like some, but mostly I wouldn't listen to a channel that was country music. I would much prefer elitist opera, which I'm prepared to pay for. I'm happy to have a subscription to a Metropolitan Opera channel that can be paid for by me and by other people who love the opera, but keep the government out of it. This is interesting. You should send Trump a copy of your book, Get Trump, and suggest he read it while sitting in the courtroom during the trial. I don't think the judge would allow that. And by the way, if anybody wants to get out of jury duty, it's easy. Just bring a copy of my book, Get Trump, into the courtroom, and you will be excused. I guarantee you. I am not happy with the seven jurors that were selected. I'm also not happy that the judge took off Wednesday. Why Wednesday? Why doesn't he take off Friday so Orthodox Jews can serve on the jury? Because many Orthodox Jews are a diversifying element in New York, which is a very non-diverse location when it comes to anti-trade Trump hatred. But by getting rid of all the Orthodox Jews, it skews the jury panel even more and more. So the judge, to accommodate religion, should have taken off on Friday. Well, you say that discriminates against Muslims. But no, if he took off on Friday, it wouldn't discriminate against Muslims. They can go to their mosques. So Friday is the day. It shouldn't be for the judge's convenience. The judge, his convenience comes last. What comes first is the Constitution. And the Constitution says you make accommodations for the free exercise of religion. Is it not ironic that Trump is being charged with felonies over a hush money payment when Congress maintains a $17 million slush fund to pay off people who accuse members of Congress of sexual improprieties? I'm not sure that that's a completely accurate statement, but to the extent it is, boy, it's certainly telling. This is interesting. Professor, one of the reasons Biden wants no escalation in the Middle East, that is no attack by Israel on Iran, is that it would lead to much higher oil and gasoline prices in the United States. This is an issue he's already vulnerable on an election year. I think that's absolutely right. I think one of the reasons, it's not the only reason, but one of the reasons an attack on Iran is it's not in the interest of Joe Biden's electoral future. If he were serving a second term and couldn't run for re-election, I don't know whether he would take the same position. But there's no question that if Israel were to attack Iran's oil fields and spike the price of oil, it would contribute to the kind of inflation that is hurting Biden in this current election. Okay. Yuri Berliner was very courageous for pointing out that during his 25 years at NPR, his employer had shifted from seeking the truth to spreading a narrative. Does no other network have anyone of the class of Mr. Berliner? They all did the same thing. Not all, but every single network has moved toward more partisan coverage. And the losers are we, the American public. We should be able to turn to one channel and get all the news. We should be able to have at least one Walter Cronkite channel. We don't have a Walter Cronkite channel today. Walter Cronkite today could not get a job because he was too objective, too fair, and too neutral. I knew Walter Cronkite. I went on his boat. He lived on Martha's Vineyard. And Walter Cronkite had very strong political views to the left, but nobody knew them. He never let them in any way affect his performance on air. We who knew him and heard him express views over dinner, we knew what his private views are, but you could never tell that from television. The same thing was true with me when I taught at Harvard Law School. If you came to my class, you would have no idea whether I was a liberal, a conservative, a Jew, or a Christian. You would have no idea from my class. If you read my articles outside of class, fine. That's very, very different. I just wish that we saw the media follow in Walter Cronkite's footsteps, but we're a long way away from that. Well, see you next week.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.